This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome here Jeremy Braddock and Kimberly Camp for this discussion about the Barnes Foundation. I'll just begin by saying that a little more than 10 years ago, when I wasn't sure whether I would come from Paris to Philadelphia, one of my colleagues took me to the Barnes. And then I thought, a city that has this collection is really worth moving to. And I've never regretted that decision. I'll say that it may come as a surprise that here at Slot we want to open this debate, and I think everybody living in Philadelphia or the area is interested in what is taking place, what will happen with the Barnes, this amazing collection. What we'll do tonight, we'll first hear a presentation of 35, 40 minutes by Jeremy Braddock. Let me introduce him. Jeremy is a fellow at Cornell University's Society for the Humanities. He has co-edited the book Directed by Alan Smithy, a collection of essays about author film. He has finished a wonderful thesis on collections and modernist collections that got the English department's prize, and is now finishing a manuscript entitled The Modernist Collector and Black Modernity, 1940-1934. Kimberly Camp, who will be responding to Jeremy's presentation, and we are very honored to have her tonight, has joined the Barnes Foundation as Executive Director and Chief Executive Officer in November 1998. Prior to this position, she was President of the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit, and then earlier on from 1898-94, she was the Director of the Experimental Gallery of the Smithsonian Institute in Washington. Mrs. Camp has been the recipient of numerous art and business awards, including the National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, Kellogg National Leadership Program, Visiting Scholar for Tokyo Geda University, and the Spirit of Detroit. She will, as the Executive Director, add information and, of course, answer to questions about the Barnes Foundation. Now, let me welcome Jeremy Braddock.
Okay, hello. Okay. In his 1960s seminar on the ethics of psychoanalysis, Jacques Lacan prefaced a few very brief comments on sublimation with the following cryptic and somewhat evasive comment. Quote, "Someone who recently published a work on collectors and those sales thanks to which collectors are supposed to get rich has long asked me to give him some ideas on the meaning of collecting. I didn't do it because I would have had to tell him to come to my seminar for 5 or 6 years. I begin with his anecdote, not as a way of preparing a psychoanalytic interpretation of the art collector, Albert Barnes, or anyone else, but rather, if possible, to suggest why Lacan's suggestion may strike us as being unsurprising, while also suggesting what we may have to gain by inverting the terms psychoanalysis and collecting in Lacan's statement. Lacan's comment seems unsurprising because the languages both of popular art promotion and of more specialized academic writing have agreed to a truly remarkable extent that the phenomenon of collecting should be understood through the terms of psychology and psychoanalysis. The mania that allegedly characterizes art collecting seems naturally to solicit such terminology, and I put that in scare quotes. It is more than fortuitous, as I hope to show, that Albert Barnes's first public battle over modern art occurred in response to the art critical adventures of a group of Philadelphia alienists. Rather than an example of a collector requiring 5 or 6 years of psychoanalysis, this incident provides compelling evidence of a group of psychiatrists who, to speak epigrammatically, were in need of a collector. It was more than 50 years ago that Aline B. Saarinen published The Proud Possessors, her originary study of 60 years of American art collecting. Her book was unmistakably admiring of the varied figures who had drawn United States art sensibilities from out of the fog of parochialism. Yet Saarinen puckishly admitted that, in their dedication of this project, the subjects of her study, quote, were not only possessors, they were also possessed. The tone of phrase no doubt indicates Saarinen's warm homage to a range of risk-taking collectors from Isabella Stewart Gardner to John Quinn to Peggy Guggenheim, yet it jokingly named the neurotic obsession of the collector in a way that continues to have cultural currency, as expressed, for instance, in the Philadelphia Museum of Art's Mad for Modernism show of 1999, which reassembled the remarkable collection of Barnes's associate, Earl Horder. Such a formulation seems to apologize in advance for, while also acknowledging, the belief that any collector's claim to act in the interests of society are preceded and perhaps are also surpassed by a real motivating pathology. If this seems like an adventitious tethering of Saarinen's popular text to Lacan's comment, consider the degree to which such a posture has been reproduced to a surprising extent in the academic fields of literary, cultural, and visual studies. A broadly psychological approach to the collector's activity has produced so much work of late that it warranted a survey of 12 recent books in the June 28, 2002 Chronicle of Higher Education, which examined what it called, quote, the centuries-old mental landscape of collectors. In these cases, collecting was studied for, quote, its role in forming new ideas of the self, end quote, a self almost always implied to be that of the collector rather than that of an imagined viewer of the collection. Because these studies tend to depict the collector as a private, isolated figure, it seems inevitable that they would open onto what the Chronicle reporter Peter Monahan called the dark side of collecting. This dark side was identified and examined in exemplary fashion by the retired New York psychoanalyst Werner Munsterberger in his 1994 study, Collecting, an Unruly Passion. Munsterberger drew from literary examples, from anecdotes, and from his own patients and acquaintances to discover that, and this is a long quote, collectors share a sense of specialness, or once not having received satisfying love or attention, or having been hurt or unfairly treated in infancy, and through their objects they feel reassured, enriched, and notable. Most characteristically, there is always an addictive component, a potential but always present unconscious modality of affect, linked to a powerful reparative need. Collecting, in Munsterberger's words, emerges as an instrument designed to allay a basic need brought on by early traumata and as an escape hatch for feelings of danger and the re-experience of loss. Because it is an effective device for relief from these pressures, it is felt as a source of pleasure and wish fulfillment. The collected objects, in other words, assume the function of the Freudian fetish, the object employed by the male child in order to guard against the danger of his own castration while also denying its possibility. Munsterberger's study anticipated by 2 years Stephen Barker's edited collection of psychoanalytic studies of Sigmund Freud's own collection of ancient Egyptian, Greek, and Roman figurines, which delved more deeply into the question of the theory's application to the theorist himself. Yet although Munsterberger's position as a practicing psychoanalyst lent a certain popular authority to his book, which was published first by Princeton University Press and then reissued as in a trade edition by Harvest Harcourt Brace, he was unwittingly reiterating from a clinical perspective the thesis proposed by Jean Baudrillard in his 1968 study, The System of Objects. That study, which had been Baudrillard's doctoral dissertation, took the phenomenon of collecting as an occasion for synthesizing the Freudian theory of the fetish with Marxian commodity fetishism, elucidating a richly suggestive system that has cast a long shadow within academia from Susan Stewart's famous study of 1993 on longing to the text surveyed almost a decade later in the Chronicle of Higher Education. Far from disqualifying him as an authority on collecting, in his belatedness, Münsterberger achieved crossover status when he was enlisted to contribute a catalog essay for the Institute of Contemporary Art, just down the street, their 2002 exhibition, Pictures, Patents, Monkeys, and More, which displayed several unorthodox collections as fetishistic systems that achieved the status of the aesthetic. When studies of art collectors have not been glowing encomia, like either Saarinen's study or, for example, the many self-produced volumes celebrating the achievement of the Washington, D.C. collector Duncan Phillips, they have similarly tended to present troubled egotists whose ambition to shape public taste has been considered a matter of social engagement only insofar as it has also been understood to be an example of mildly perverse fetishism. What I wish to stress is the way each of these approaches understands collecting to be an almost entirely interior practice, what Baudrillard called a discourse addressed to oneself. From this point of view, we could be excused if we thought the exemplary collector might appear to be someone not like Albert Barnes or John G. Johnson, for example, but perhaps Stefan Breitweiser, the 31-year-old French art thief who, before being discovered in May of 2002, had amassed over the course of a decade $1.4 billion of small masterpieces from minor European museums and displayed them in his mother's house. Although I am quite specifically sympathetic with certain psychoanalytic approaches to collecting, the approaches I have just briefly outlined have the disadvantage of isolating the activity of the collector from its wider social situation, hence the centuries-old mental landscape of collectors of the Chronicle piece. To return to the epigram, there has been a surprising consensus that the collector requires psychoanalysis. By focusing contrarily upon a group of psychiatrists who required a collector, we will be able to glimpse historical and intellectual currents that are often excluded from both academic and museological practices. In this way, the objects of a collection do not represent the self in any private or simple way, but also represent systems of knowledge in whose name collectors may act, hoping thereby to claim agency and authority through the institutional acceptance of these systems. I'm therefore less interested this evening in providing an originary moment in Albert Barnes's long history of confrontations in Philadelphia and elsewhere than I am in presenting this episode as contributing to a genealogy of the Barnes Foundation itself by showing how it participates in a broader series of struggles by means of which modern art was institutionalized in the United States. Specifically, I will discuss what appears to be Barnes's first public confrontation about modern art, which dates between April and October 1921, just over a year before the chartering of the Barnes Foundation. In this encounter, Barnes attacked a group of alienists, representatives of the Philadelphia establishment, on the ostensible subject of an exhibition of American modernist paintings. Because the alienists declaimed the art on the basis of its alleged insanity, Barnes took this opportunity to announce his own interests in tying modern art to the new psychology represented both by the Vienna School of Psychoanalysis and by American pioneers including William James and John Dewey. Rather than indicating the pathology of the collector, this incident involves, on the one hand, a strikingly literal interpretation of the old association of modernism with insanity, and, on the other hand, of the institutionalization of modern art to the acceptance of modern psychology and psychoanalysis. What is unique about Barnes's ambitions as a collector is how thoroughly they involved the mutual involvement of these two fields. We need to see in this moment less the struggle of eccentric intellectuals than the contest of ideas and their fates in institutions that represent and practice them. On April 16, 1921, the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts opened their exhibition of paintings and drawings showing the later tendencies in art at Broad and Cherry Streets in Center City, Philadelphia. 2 days after the exhibition opened, Albert Barnes would write to Academy faculty member Arthur Carles, declaring that the show was, quote, the first real move to shake Philadelphia out of the lethargy which has been the reproach to us from artists and collectors from other cities. And this letter was printed in the Inquirer, I believe. Inasmuch as the central narrative of this talk may bear out Barnes' assessment of his native city, it is nonetheless true that Philadelphia had a more complex relationship with modernism than the letter might indicate. Since the appointment of Leopold Stokowski as director of the Philadelphia Orchestra in 1912, and the orchestra's well-known American premiere of Schoenberg's Commerce Symphony 3 years later, Philadelphia had been associated with the vanguard of modernist music in the United States. The city's relationship to modernist art was somewhat more vexed, as Sylvia Yount has shown, though not entirely lethargic. The Pennsylvania Academy itself, sometimes considered to be a bastion of conservatism, could also claim a history of having sponsored progressive exhibitions which, in fact, predate the 1913 Armory Show. In more recent memory, in 1916, Walnut Street's McLees Galleries has had exhibited, albeit 3 years after the fact, pieces selected from the Armory Show and from other second-generation modernists. In other circles, a series of avant-garde masks, sponsored by Academy associates in the mid-teens, marked an attempt to replicate the culture of Diaghilev and the Russian Ballet for Philadelphia. Moreover, these events, as well as New York exhibitions such as those at Alfred Stieglitz's 291 Gallery, received significant promotion in the pages of the Inquirer from the art critic and Pennsylvania Academy alumna, Helen Henderson. As Barnes was suggesting, though, Philadelphia's art market and institutions were not as radically transformed as New York's in the wake of the Armory Show, and by 1921, the advances of the mid-teens seemed in danger of disappearing. Both curators of the 1916 McLees Galleries exhibit had unexpectedly died in 1918, and Helen Henderson left Philadelphia and the Inquirer the following year, leaving behind her a journalistic culture largely hostile to modernism. And like most other American cities, Philadelphia lacked a major municipal art museum comparable to the Met in New York. The Academy thus held a central position in the question of exhibiting new work, and its faculty and constituency were strongly divided on the question of modernism. In the early 1910s, the Academy had hired two conservative artists, Philip Leslie Hale and Daniel Garber, thus seeming to indicate a movement away from the avant-garde. Yet other instructors were modernist sympathizers, among them the recipient of Barnes's 1921 letter, Arthur Carles, who had been hired in 1918. Upon his appointment, Carles, along with fellow Academy alumnus William Yarrow, joined in a renewed effort to establish modernist art in Philadelphia through shows at the Academy. The first of these exhibitions, 1920s Paintings and Drawings by Representative Modern Masters, was modeled after the Armory Show and provided a survey of the history of modernist work, along with several examples of contemporary pieces. Unlike the Armory Show, however, the Modern Masters exhibition did not attempt to situate American work amidst European painting and sculpture. The 250 pieces were, in fact, almost entirely European. The two most prominent Americans were James McNeill Whistler and Mary Cassatt, both of whose careers had been established abroad. The following year's exhibition of paintings and drawings showing the later tendencies in art, on the other hand, was closely modeled upon the Forum Exhibition of Modern American Painters held at New York's Anderson Galleries in 1916. Yarrow's and Carles's citation of this earlier show did not consist simply in its preference for American pieces, but also in the way in which the selected pieces fashioned what Yount names, quote, a coalition of modernist groups, drawing from members of the Eight, from Stieglitz's 291 group, as well as artists associated with Walter Ahrensberg and with Gertrude and Leo Stein, respectively. Pieces from the show included Joseph Stella's Battle of Light, Coney Island Mardi Gras, Florian Stettheimer's Asbury Park South, Charles DeMuth's Aucassin and Nicolette, and Marston Hartley's New Mexico Landscape. And the show also represented several Philadelphia painters, including George Biddle, William Blackens, as well as Carles and Yarrow themselves. The show thus not only appealed to a sense of post-war American nativism without, except for one example, making reference to the war, but also sought to align the Philadelphia art scene with the New York avant-garde. Although some reviewers noted that many of the pieces that were included in the show were 10 years old, this did not deter the majority of the Philadelphia press from receiving the show as being controversial, using in some cases the familiar metaphors of modernism as warfare, anarchism, or in one case, jazz. Thomas Jewell Craven's glowing review for The Dial, on the other hand, praised the show for the consistent interest of its selections, as well as for the size both of the show and of the Academy's exhibition space, whose expansiveness permitted what he called new valuations. Although Craven titled his review The Awakening of the Academy, he significantly stressed that the show itself was evidence of the widespread public acceptance of modernism. In Craven's words, quote, "The day of condemnation is over. The public has accepted the new painting, has reconciled it with contemporary life, and seeing that it is not so new after all, but closely affiliated with the art of the past, has come to like it. It is difficult to judge the valences of Craven's rhetoric here. On the one hand, Craven was not the only critic to note that the show did not represent modernism as a violent or revolutionary form, and this was an argument Barnes himself would later often make in emphasizing what he called the continuity of the great traditions of art. On the other hand, the public acceptance he tried to demonstrate was not confirmed by sales from the show. Of the 12 pieces that were sold, 8 were sold to Barnes himself. Moreover, Craven's claim that the exhibition, quote, did not provoke wild excitement, end quote, was either disingenuous or premature, ignoring as it did the key reactions for which the show remains most memorable, the public declaration of its artists' insanity by a consortium of powerful Philadelphia alienists. On the evening of April 29th, 2 weeks after the opening of the Later Tendencies show, and this is a week after Barnes's public congratulation of Carl's, but 2 months before the Dial of Peace appeared, a group of Philadelphia alienists held a series of lectures at Rittenhouse Square's Art Alliance on the occasion of the exhibition. The event's impresario was Dr. Francis Xavier Durkheim, a neurologist famous both for his collaborations with Edward Muybridge at the University of Pennsylvania and also for having been assigned to attend Woodrow Wilson after his stroke. His associates in this adventure included the private clinician W.B. Wadsworth, J. Madison Taylor of Temple University, and Charles W. Burr of the University of Pennsylvania, the last of whom would remain a powerful figure at Penn long enough to frustrate some of Barnes's greatest aspirations. Two other psychologists, Drs. Ludlam and Phillips, did not deliver lectures, but having themselves visited the Later Tendencies exhibit with the others, were present to confirm the diagnoses of their colleagues. Durkheim and company clearly envisioned the occasion as what is now known as a media event, and the Philadelphia Evening Bulletin gleefully obliged them by quoting in the next day's edition such memorable assessments as these: a chamber of horrors, a grave of eccentricity, a humbug exhibit with imbeciles, children, and ignoramuses as the principal exhibitors. 2 weeks later, items in the University of Pennsylvania's Weekly Review and in the Brooklyn Daily Eagle showed more clearly the extent to which the alienists treated the paintings, which were probably not available in reproduction for the lectures, as symptomatic evidence of the insanity of the artists. And here are some long passages about the lectures. Wadsworth spoke on abnormality in art, is the name of the title of the lecture, and went into technical discussion of those who were defective in vision and were unable to see color and form clearly, of whom he noted in the exhibition 6 types. He also found, studying the pictures of the show as a clinician, that the works represented those, quote, ghastly lesions of the mind and body which usually land people in the hospitals and in the asylums, end quote, but sometimes, as he expressed it, permit them to walk around, feed themselves, avoid a commission in lunacy, and paint. Dr. Burr's paper was titled The Evils of False Art, in which he found quite a little that is degenerate, and this is from the Penn Weekly Review article, that is, which creates or is intended to create unhealthy feelings of pleasure in the diseased onlooker and which a healthy-souled artist would not have painted. Dr. Burr pointed out some works that recalled Blake, but a drunken, lustful Blake. And he noted, in speaking of the modernist critics who defend this art, that some of their literature is, quote, of little more use as an intellectual illuminant to guide the stumbling steps of the eager seeker for truth than the phosphorescence of the fish is to illuminate the world. And Durkheim was quoted as saying, quote, I can only infer that, in a large degree, the pathological element enters into these paintings and drawings, both in the representation of colors and of the forms. I cannot draw any other conclusions. I think the main feature is the disease of color sense and the disease of a great many other mental faculties. Certainly we cannot be expected to cast aside the art which the world has acquired and to accept this thing in its place. I think if we do, we should all of us present ourselves to be certified to institutions for mentally unbalanced people. End quote. The temerity of the alienist can be measured if we do not fail to notice that in reading these paintings as evidence of dangerous neurological deformities, Durkheim, Burr, and company were effectively calling for the institutionalization of living American artists, some of whom were more than figuratively their neighbors. In other ways, however, this gesture was almost embarrassingly hackneyed. It had been almost 40 years, after all, since Max Nordau had claimed in the now infamous study Degeneration that, quote, criminals, prostitutes, anarchists, and pronounced lunatics manifest the same mental characteristics and, for the most part, the same somatic features as did the degenerate authors and artists of the modern movement. Yet such ideas die hard, and Durkheim's relationship to Nordau proves closer than may be suggested by the similarities of their naively diagnostic readings of modern art. Degeneracy theory had indeed become a popular practice among somatic neurologists in the United States, proliferating throughout the 1890s and reaching a high point between 1907 and 1917. In fact, as Nathan Hale has suggested, although hereditary determinism would also lead to the abuses of eugenic practices, some American proponents of degeneracy theory were actually humanitarian radicals seeking sweeping social reforms such as the careful regulation of working conditions. Yet it was precisely this school of neurology that was threatened by the rise of psychoanalysis in America following Freud's 1909 visit. And among American cities, it had been Philadelphia that was the most resistant to the new psychology and to psychoanalysis in particular. Since 1911, when Freud began to be hotly debated in psychological associations, both Durkheim and Burr had made names for themselves attacking the Vienna school. Durkheim, in Nathan Hale's words, countered the theories of psychoanalysis with an extreme somatic position that lightly disguised degeneracy theory. The fundamental intrinsic cause of insanity was neuropathy, which he defined as a nervous system fundamentally aberrant and defective in development. Neuropathy weakened resistance to nervous and mental diseases. This was a more extreme position than that taken by most neurologists in the 1890s. By the late 1910s, however, Durkheim and Burr were learning to concede that the ascendancy of psychoanalysis in the United States was not to be stopped. This still did not deter them from continuing to speculate about the moral implications of the new psychology, in which Freudianism was both a root cause, Durkheim once called psychoanalysis a lesion of the proprieties, as well as a symptom of a more generalized cultural degeneration in which, quote, America's once great social consciousness devoted to high ideals of freedom and morality was being fragmented by polyglot races, selfish individualism, heterogeneous class divisions, demoralizing social philosophy, and conflicting interests, end quote. The sociological implications of this last assessment are of considerable importance for their probable relationship to Barnes's interest in the new psychology. The rising generation of Freudians lacked not only the institutional authority enjoyed by Durkheim and Burr, but they largely came from social class backgrounds that were less vaunted than were those of establishment neurologists. Barnes's own working class background and progressive interests may naturally have drawn him to such figures, and it is certainly true that Barnes shared with them an intellectual antipathy to the social and psychological determinism exemplified by the somatic school. Although the point is, for my purposes, certainly an adventitious one, is nevertheless worth pointing out that whereas Charles Burr had in recent memory commented that psychoanalysis represented what he called a return to darkest Africa, it was in the very year following these events that Albert Barnes began to assemble his famous collection of African sculpture, which he pointedly integrated among the European and American modernist pieces of his collection, while also advertising his interest in them as a means of establishing alliances with progressive African-American intellectuals such as Charles S. Johnson and Alan Locke. Durkheim's diagnostic symposium on the later tendencies show both followed and upstaged Barnes' public letter of congratulations to Arthur Carles. And in the wake of Helen Henderson's departure from the Philadelphia Inquirer, the local newspaper's coverage of the Art Alliance event appeared implicitly to support their derision of the modernist artists. Barnes responded by soliciting and placing articles in other publications, the newly founded Journal of the Arts, and in the Brooklyn Eagle. That Barnes fully comprehended the professional psychological subtext beneath Durkheim's attacks may be judged from his letter, which was quoted at length by the Brooklyn reporter Hamilton Field, which appeared in an article with the excellent title, Dr. Barnes Says Modern Artists Are Not Insane. And here is a quote from the letter, which was reproduced in the Brooklyn Eagle. It would seem from the editorial, and he's responding to an editorial which had already defended the show against Durkheim. It would seem from the editorial that these learned doctors classified the artists who exhibited their work at the Academy as sufferers from a well-recognized form of mental disease. It would take more than the statements of the doctors mentioned to make out a case that would bear analysis by anyone versed in the fundamental principles of normal and abnormal psychology, in which science, I believe, it is a general opinion of those who specialize in psychology that the doctors mentioned are not qualified to speak. I believe that Doctors Durkheim, Burr, and Wadsworth come within the category of what is known as old hats, that is, men who have arrived at positions of eminence by conforming to the traditions of a bygone age, standing pat on somebody else's thinking, and vociferously denouncing the work of men who have devoted their lives to research work in art and science. To such men as the doctors mentioned, the monumental work done by Freud, Jung, and Adler is a closed book. But to men like Professor Holt and Professor Dewey of Columbia, the work of Freud and his colleagues is of fundamental significance and importance to normal and mentally diseased society. In short, I think that when Doctors Durkheim, Burr, and Wadsworth make public statements concerning matters about which they have no scientific knowledge, they can be classed as ignoramuses with a penchant for limelighting. End quote. Although Barnes is best known for his advocacy of American pragmatism, particularly for his personal friendship and collaboration with John Dewey, this letter provides evidence that Barnes had kept up to date with the Vienna School of Psychoanalysis, which was becoming increasingly available to American readers through translations from insiders such as A.A. Brill, although it should be said also that Barnes was fluent in German and had traveled in Germany, and so it's possible that he had read them in German as well. So psychoanalysis was available in translation, as well as in the work of Anglophone sympathizers such as Bernard Hart's Psychology of Insanity, which Barnes recommending to his colleagues. Barnes had received a degree in medicine from the University of Pennsylvania and had interned in the state hospital in Warren, Pennsylvania, and had remained current in his readings in the burgeoning fields of psychology. As Barnes would soon claim in the pages of the New Republic, not only his collecting practices, but the very organization and operation of his chemical factory at 40th and Market Street had been strongly impacted by his readings in pragmatist psychology, namely William James's Psychology and John Dewey's How We Think, as key texts read by himself and his employees. His aesthetic theory, formalized in The Art and Painting in 1925, drew strongly upon the pragmatist philosopher George Santayana's aesthetics, in particular the books The Sense of Beauty and Reason and Art. Although Barnes's published work and his later career generally testify to the greater impact of the American pragmatists, we should not read his citation of James and Dewey, along with Freud, Jung, and Adler, as merely being a sign of an earlier indecision, but suggesting rather a more general cultural moment in which pragmatism and psychoanalysis were understood as together challenging intellectual paradigms in the United States. The least familiar among the names cited by Barnes, Edwin Holt, was in fact a former student and close friend of William James, whose 1915 book, The Freudian Wish and Its Place in Ethics, had been one of the most widely read American popularizations of Freud. Despite their important differences in early 20th century America, there was a strong sense that pragmatist philosophy and psychoanalysis shared many of the same social aspirations. Indeed, Freud's opportunity to meet with James had been one of the most hotly anticipated aspects of the Clark Lectures of 1909, which he and Holt had both attended. And as late as the 1920s, it was hoped by some American psychoanalysts that Dewey would become the figurehead of their American efforts. For his part, Freud once said that Dewey was, quote, one of the few Americans for whom I have a truly high regard. The relationship of these two schools of philosophy and psychology in the United States generally, and Barnes' understanding of and involvement with them specifically, merits further consideration. I wish, however, to focus on the specificity of this moment in American cultural politics. Although this exchange had been read as evidence of Barnes's overreaching eccentricity, he was more than justified in dismissing Durkheim and his crew as old hat. Albeit not without serious debate, Freudian psychoanalysis had been taught in American universities as early as 1917, by which time most of the major works were available in American editions. More pertinently, even European critics of Freud had been alarmed at the intensely biological approach of the Philadelphian attack on psychoanalysis, which they viewed as a return to 19th century principles. In this context, it is useful also to remember that many of the pieces in the later tendencies show being more than a decade old, Thomas Jewell Craven was not simply being wishful when he claimed that the public has come to accept the new painting. Indeed, even a critical review in the Philadelphia Press tellingly equivocated in its series of headlines, "Modernism invades Academy's galleries, artistic bombshell exploded in the stronghold of conservatism, damage is but slight." The true significance of these engagements, I suggest, consisted neither in the breaking through of either modernism or Freud, nor in the way in which they may have marked an embarrassing admission of Philadelphia's belatedness or lethargy. Rather, what was at stake was the question of how the practices of modern art and the new psychology, having already in some sense arrived, would be represented in and by institutions and thereby assume cultural authority for the future. This was indicated in an unexpected way by Barnes's final gesture in the battle with the Philadelphia alienists. An October article in the American Art News reported on what had been Barnes's recent offer, quote, to donate his entire collection of paintings, valued at millions of dollars, and a gallery to house them to the city of Philadelphia, if Dr. Durkheim could prove himself qualified in the science of normal and abnormal psychology. This was an offer he later improved by suggesting that he would also provide room for display for the collection of John G. Johnson. Barnes enclosed a series of 8 questions which he invited Durkheim to address. The American Art News reprinted them in their entirety, but here are 2 of them. First, show in scientific terms the difference in basic principles between the pictures of Gauguin, Degas, and Renoir, which Dr. Durkheim says he does not condemn, and those exhibited last spring at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, which Dr. Durkheim says are the work of insane people. And fifth, if he will point out in any authoritative work on psychology the principle that makes common sense as applied to art out of the sentence from Durkheim's presentation, the colors employed in the alleged paintings were in no sense those seen in nature, nor could their use be construed as suggesting or evoking a sense of the beautiful. End quote. The grandiosity of Barnes's gesture obscures the subtlety of its premise, whereas the argument here, as before, appears to be about the figure's relative authority on normal and abnormal psychology. The true authority in this case could be argued to be the acknowledged value of Barnes's already considerable art collection, which, it seems to be agreed, would have been a significant public bequest to the city of Philadelphia in 1921. Indeed, understandably hearing in the crescendo of this story the rumblings of Barnes's later public battles, critics have failed to notice in these lines an early, if somewhat encrypted, statement of intention to build an institution very like the Barnes Foundation. It is thus no mere coincidence that just over a year following these exchanges, on December 4, 1922, Barnes received a charter from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to establish the Barnes Foundation as quote, and this is a quote from the bylaws of Barnes Foundation, quote, an art gallery founded as an educational experiment under the principles of modern psychology, end quote. In this seemingly facetious proposal of Francis Durkheim, we should also hear Barnes's intention to link the fates of modern psychology and modern art through the formal institutionalization of his collection. In their grotesquely sensationalist restaging of the moment of Max Nordau's degeneration, Durkheim, Wadsworth, and Burr were not merely decrying what they defined as modernist art, but they were also making a last stand against the imminent popular acceptance of Freud, who in turn proved to have enormous popularity both in mass culture and, of course, in the university. What they failed to recognize was the degree to which their blustery intervention was itself participating in some of the by then well-established paradigms of avant-garde sensationalism, the alleged riots that attended Dadaist events or the premiere of Rite of Spring, for example. Barnes, for his part, practiced sensationalism of a different kind, one that, in its public expressions, was based upon a cultural authority that was, like his fortune, self-made. Drawing strongly from John Dewey's instrumentalist position, Barnes argued that modern psychology and art represented two different but intimately related means of scientific humanistic inquiry. The institutions of modernity therefore required reorganization so as to allow for these disciplines to work in concert. In this way, the Academy's representation of modernist pieces was only half the battle. What remained to be achieved, in Barnes's view, was an employment of these artworks as instruments of a more generalized reform of educational and psychological practices addressed to and expressive of the conditions of modernity. It does not tell the whole story to consider it as being ideas working themselves out in history. For one thing, some of Barnes's ideas, however appropriate they may or may not have been to industrial democracy, were not widely adopted. We are also missing the point of this debate if we think of it merely as being a confrontation among strong-willed, eccentric individuals. Even if they were not directly involved, the struggle is perhaps better conceived as being one over the control of cultural institutions through which such ideas may find expression and claim authority. Barnes wished to claim cultural authority through expressing his willingness to build such an institution, though he was really promising, as we now know, an institution that aimed to reform the existing institutional models of the museum and the university. As a way of finally making visible the stakes and contours of this battle, we should consider not only that it took place 8 years after the Armory Show, but it took place 8 years before the opening of the Museum of Modern Art in New York in 1929. One merely needs to be reminded of the disparity between the extreme functionalism of the space and arrangement of MoMA and the pointed and provocative heterogeneity of the Barnes Foundation to be made aware of the fact that modernism was institutionalized through a series of struggles both against expressed enemies like Durkheim and Burr, and among its advocates in the United States and elsewhere. Among the many unique virtues of the Barnes Foundation is the way it serves as an objective record of these struggles, showing how the understanding of modernism we have inherited might have been very different, and how our historical knowledge of it might be made different in the future.
Thank you.
Is that your lovely wife next to you? Hi, Mrs. Pick. Good friends of mine.
So maybe, I don't know whether you want to respond now or take questions. I think what Jeremy gave us was a view of Barnes as a doctor, after all. He was a doctor and an educator, not just a collector. And I think this is one interesting point of departure in his genealogy. That's how he came to the idea of the foundation, having tried a number of other venues in the context of Philadelphia. But so,
I just want to say that I think that with Jeremy's paper, and I'm very glad I had opportunity to read some of your dissertation, because I heard some of it emerging in this version of the paper, that certainly Barnes' relationship and involvement with psychoanalysis and psychology does bear much further study. It is commendable, I think, the research that you have done, particularly without benefit of archives, which is always difficult, I know, for people who are eager to write about the foundation and all of that while we're in the process of organizing some of those things. In that, in finding over an archive of about 800,000 documents, because Barnes kept a copy of everything he sent as well as everything sent to him, we find, for example, as early as 1930, that there are over 100 schools in the United States using Barnes methodologies for the creation of programs. So unlike what a lot of people have assumed, that Barnes ideas were so idiosyncratic as to not be widely accepted, not really the case. In fact, he was very deeply engaged and involved in a number of different organizations. And his work in Philadelphia went much broader than I think a lot of people realize. as much as important to the foundation as the psychological aspects. Barnes had an underlying mission of social justice that had him involved very deeply in the labor movement, in education. One of the letters I was reading, and I brought a few letters that are back and forth between, I'll share these with you later, many of the letters, he often talks about people asking him for money when in fact he's been a donor for years, mm-hmm. and they're unaware of it. So his involvement was very broad, and he was someone deeply engaged in the psychological framework of education, in essence. Not just Dewey, but James and Santayana as well greatly influenced Barnes. The other thing I would say about Barnes and his relationship with Freud is that Barnes was a big fan of Freud to a certain extent. He said often in his letters that Freud was his own worst enemy because he attempted to try and define things so narrowly as to suggest that only his methodology was the proper way and that there were examples where other approaches were just as effective. And so you see Barnes not only in his letters, but I think most apparent, and the thing that has been the most exciting to me in getting to know Barnes through his letters, I actually channel Barnes now. If anyone has scotch, I can prove it. But yes, yeah, single malt pre-World War I, that was his thing. Hated scotch before I got to the Barnes. Now it's all I drink. I don't get it. Barnes was constantly testing, reevaluating, and questioning his own assumptions. This was not someone, I think a lot of the public has a notion that Barnes sort of came up with this idea of how he wanted people to look at art, and it was his way and no way. And that's far from accurate. Barnes was constantly challenging his own assumptions. He was constantly reassessing his assumptions, his values. In the letters that he writes back and forth to Dewey, and those letters are, there are over 1,600 of them. He's constantly testing what he's thinking. You hear this self-doubt coming out all the time. You know, he talks about whether or not what he's doing is worthwhile if he can only reach one student. Or is this something that's learned en masse? So all of these things that he's experimenting with. Interestingly, he also says in an exchange, and I'll stop here because I'm sure there must be lots of questions. In some of the exchanges between Barnes and Dewey, they talk about, and this is early on in the history of the foundation, they talk about the danger of what happens when they're no longer here. Because they say the Barnes Foundation is an experiment. It's meant to be dynamic. It's meant to change based on the needs of society. That same kind of testing and reassessing and evaluating. And he said the big danger in what we're trying to do is that when we're no longer here, people in an attempt to do this are going to set it in stone. And in doing that, they're going to destroy it. And interestingly, that's sort of is a good segue into talking about sort of where the foundation is now, because I think a lot of the efforts of the past since Barnes' death really in many ways did that.
Yeah. There are questions?
I read it in a number of different ways. Would you like to? Okay. Right. Yeah. Okay. So the question is, how does Barnes's method of arrangement function in concert with his pedagogy? Let's see. I guess I have there, and actually, I'll finish this with a question. There are three ways that I understand this is operating. And the first is, there's a doctoral dissertation written by a woman named Megan Grandebar at the University of Texas at Austin, who It's been very helpful to me. And she claims that in the last 15 years of Barnes' life, from 35 to 50, Barnes was not acquiring art as aggressively as he had been before, but was instead working on what he felt would be the final arrangement of the collection.
She wrote her paper without the archives, too.
That's true. She did. Yeah. Okay. So, okay. Well, I hope you'll
respond. It's not quite
to this.
Accurate.
Okay.
Yeah.
But in any case, her conclusion ends with a concept of what Barnes called transferred values, which explains attempts to explain the way in which the wall, a particular wall, will function as an aesthetic unit somehow. And it seemed to me that an article I read in the Philadelphia Daily News not long ago was attempting to unpack this, the way in which this functioned. And perhaps you can elaborate further, but as I understand it, Barnes wanted to accentuate certain features of a particular work of art, its use of color, its use of line, its use of space, by showing how by including other objects and other works of art in which these elements were also functional. So just to cite an obvious example, a particular pairing of colors which would be reiterated among a few pieces, and Barnes thought that that understanding these works as an ensemble would accentuate what he called the aesthetic experience of a work of art. So that would be one way of understanding, of answering the question. Another way of looking at it is a concept that Barnes draws from Santayana. Santayana describes two forms of beauty, what he calls the ornamental or decorative, and then what he calls the utilitarian or structural. And for Barnes, as for Santayana, and especially for Barnes, these two elements participate in every work of art, but in some cases they're more strongly present than in others. So so the ornamental would tend to deal with the immediate visceral appeal of a work of art, and a structural principle would reveal its formal organization more strongly. And it seems to me that this has been a good way of accounting for one thing which seems to repeat in the galleries a great deal, which is a sort of interaction between, on the one hand, Renoir and Cézanne, Renoir perhaps being more decorative, Cézanne being more structural, and to a lesser extent, Matisse and Picasso. And it seems to me that oftentimes this is reiterated, it seems to me at least, that Cézanne often is anchored with andirons under paintings rather than, say, something like a bowl, or perhaps a more ornamental object would appear under a Renoir. Perhaps you could challenge or confirm that reading. But I also think that it seems to me that there's at least one other principle that's operative in the galleries, and that actually runs against something which Barnes warns us against in the art and painting, which is to view art simply for subject matters. It's something Barnes says he does not want to do. But it does seem to me that in several of the rooms there does seem to be something of a symbolic function that is related more strongly to subject matter. I would say, well, just to list one example without going into greater detail, what's the best example? Well, there's a wall in which there is, I'm trying to think of the best example without giving away. There's a room that has a lot of birds, and there's another room in which there's a picture of Christ's circumcision, and on that very wall, and perhaps right next to it, is a pair of scissors. So it seems to me that there's something perhaps perverse sometimes, but I think also there are moments in which it's more pointed, and it does seem to me that that there's some significance to the fact that that the room in which Barnes's image appears, which is the sketch of de Chirico's portrait of Barnes, the portrait is not actually in the galleries, is also one of the rooms in which African sculpture appears. And it seems to me that in this room in particular, Barnes is making a relationship or signing his relationship to his interest in progressive social issues and African American concerns in particular with his own work. So those would be roughly and crudely stated the three ways in which I understand.
But you're on such a roll.
Well, I don't know.
I think what I also heard in her question was the relationship of to this notion of insanity and trying mm-hmm. to get from there to reading or somehow
right.
decoding what Barnes' pedagogy was,
yeah.
which is really not addressed in the body of the paper. I will say that psychology, education, methodology played as much into what Barnes was doing as the issues of aesthetics, to be sure. Barnes' ideas about why he did the ensembles are very interesting, and I think that a lot of people, again, because we're still in the process of cataloging all of this material, and it's not available yet to outside scholars, that there is so much there that we still have to share with people about what he was doing. The ensembles were fluid up until the day of Barnes' death. They should be looked at as aesthetic equations. I often say to people the analogy to use is walking into a math department of a major university, and in each classroom, professor is putting a particular equation on the board. That's what those ensembles are. They're aesthetic equations. They move between the formal elements of art, showing aesthetic tradition, and contemporary interpretation of aesthetic tradition, where innovation or invention are apparent. Barnes was a big joker, also. A lot of people take him far too seriously. He had a rakish sense of humor. When I met Barnes' secretary from 1940 to 1944, and we spotted her only because she came to the gallery and was pointing out her photograph in one of the postcards that we sell in the store. And I said, based on my reading of Barnes' archives, I get a sense that he was sort of a cross between Groucho Marx and Albert Einstein. She said, that's a perfect description. So there are those little side jokes that are within the gallery all the time. The one room where there's a corbeille, it's in on the first floor, and I forget all the room numbers, but it's a room where there's a corbeille, and I forget the name of the piece. I'm as bad with titles as Barnes was. A rather indecent woman laying on her back with her legs crossed, not quite crossed. And below that is a Pennsylvania German blanket chest. And the name on the chest happens to be Susanna. It's,
yeah.
you know, you'd have to know the Susanna and the Elder's painting to make some kind of sort of inside joke connection there. He does the same thing with Puvis de Chavannes and Milton Avery in another one of the rooms. There are birds in every room, but there's also children's art in almost every room. The foundation has an extraordinary collection of work by women artists as well. So the breadth of these social statements is really profound, but even within that, multi-tiered interpretive strategies behind those ensembles designed in many ways to be that equation. And no one would expect anyone to walk into a math department and walk up to a very complex problem and say, oh, I get it. Yeah. All of these ensembles were designed for intense, intimate, educational involvement with small groups of students over a long period of time. But the first part of the program dealing with the methodologies, and Barnes said, in some of his writing, he said that he thought that eye movement was directly related to brain development, and he didn't know how he was going to prove it, but he knew there was a relationship. He talked a lot about how he thought that artists perceive at a higher level than other people, and that if somehow he could teach people to see the way that an artist sees, that process would enhance their ability to perceive. That would then build critical problem-solving skills, and you could therefore build a better democracy. Barnes, in one of my favorite speeches, goes out and talks for an hour. He's asked to speak about the collection, and I guess they wanted him to wax quixotic for 2 hours about Cézanne and Renoir, and he spoke about firefighting for 2 hours. But the point he was making, he said, and I'm paraphrasing this, that when a passerby sees a building on fire, they might notice that there's a fire. It might impede his or her progress. In that same moment, the fireman notices the smell of the smoke, whether someone might be inside, whether there's an engine coming from the distance. He said the role of the barns is to create firefighters in the broader society. So that experiment in education and that pedagogy was fluid, it was dynamic, it was in constant change, it was constantly questioning. And I think that that's the real key behind looking at the sort of psychological analysis of what Barnes was doing, his studies in Germany. He did attend the University of Berlin and the University of Heidelberg, so rather extensive studies in Germany. But I think that that's where the real meat of this whole issue really lies. The question is, if the pedagogy and what Barnes was doing was so fluid, then how does that sort of jive with what this gentleman says is the will, which actually is not the will. The charter, they're two separate documents, but how does that jive with how he sort of set up this preservation? I think, and this is just my theory based on what I have read to date, I think Barnes realized that we didn't get it. And I think he set it in stone as a way of saying, this methodology around which this collection gets used can still remain fluid. But he knew then, in the same way that we deal with now, of this intense desire to say, to hell with education and pedagogy, make it a museum, get rid of those ensembles, spread this stuff out and show it the way it's supposed to be. I've had people say to me, when are you going to get that African stuff out of the barns? So I think he was very cognizant of that kind of sentiment that was around the foundation. And I think it was his way of ensuring that that wasn't going to happen. In that regard, the indenture was a very successful legal vehicle. Barnes' first attorney was John Johnson. After Johnson's death, he then hired Owen Roberts. So he had excellent legal counsel. But he made sure that it would stay. And I think were that charter not in place, I think the foundation would have ceased to exist a long time ago.
I have a couple of responses and comments to what you're saying. One is, I was thinking about when doctors become art critics, we all have to watch out. They certainly got it wrong when they tried to explain El Greco, that it was his astigmatism that caused the shapes. So it's not just the modernists who've been subject to medical misinterpretation. But the earlier question about installation gave me an insight. One of the critiques that people make, or novices, or first-time visitors to the barns, when they don't really understand or even know to look at the rationale behind an ensemble, is, I can't see. Why is that so high out of but I think that his later tendencies of art show that we talked about in 1921, if we could see pictures of that, that would be installed not in our current sense of taking time to look at each thing at the proper 60 inches rather from the floor and so on. But it was either skied, as it was called, or hung cheek to jowl. And that Barnes' sense of what makes a good installation really was formed in that period of seeing those shows at the Pennsylvania Academy.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, although it's a much more pointedly...
He had a different kind of a rationality.
Yeah, but I think you're absolutely right.
Hi, Joe.
You met something about Germany. When does Penn break up? When does the law of Germany? When do they get a license?
There are, you mean the relationship between Barnes and Penn?
This whole state of affairs of the psychological, that the people here are teaching psychology.
Oh, when do they leave?
When do they sort of break?
I'm not really sure, actually, to tell you the truth.
Maybe they haven't yet.
I mean, okay. Yeah, well, I mean, after all, Penn is most famous now for cognitive psychology, which is, you know, very anti-Freudian.
How typical or untypical was that? Was Philadelphia particularly entrenched with pulses in place in those terms?
My sense is that is the case. I mean, it seems that Freud is much... He's becoming very popularly successful, right, through these translations, and to the extent that even people like Brill and Clarence Oberndorf are feeling that they need to control the practice of psychoanalysis. I mean, when is Wild Psychoanalysis written? It's around this time, isn't it? But Freud's attempt to disclaim certain American psychoanalytic practices. Hopkins begins teaching Freud in 17. It happens gradually, but Freud begins to be debated in various psychological associations as early as 1911. But my sense is that Philadelphia is especially resistant. As it did.
As it had to use the term in topic of art. What did it mean in terms of the relationship between the two words?
I think there certainly is a relationship because psychological degeneracy is for these figures tied to a certain moral degeneracy. But it's
Sexuality?
Well, yeah, sexuality, but also, I mean, just sort of a general general dissolution of social categories, right? In which the degenerate or insane or, you know, eugenically deficient are having a greater say, and it seems clearly tied in some of Durkheim and Burr's writings to immigration, for example, I think that there is a genealogy there. I would not say that Durkheim and Burr are quite as authoritarian. I mean, needless to say, because I think in some senses, particularly by the 20s, their rhetoric is especially ramped up. For example, Durkheim published a book in 22 called The Biology of the Internal Secretions. And in 25 he did a revised edition with a lengthy attack on Freud at the end, appended to the end of it, which I think is really because in some senses there's a sense that it's a last attempt to defeat psychoanalysis, which they realize in some senses is a losing battle.
Are you speaking to me?
Yes.
No, I didn't.
I think there is a trend in psychoanalysis. Very recently, we have several, not necessarily the best, and they have very, very famous psychoanalysts analyzed as novels. And I think this will be on PBS for later time. But I'd like to call that Dr. Lawrence was questioning himself in the selection of demons. And he wasn't, he picked up a lot of these things and knowing nothing really about them at the very beginning.
I don't agree with that. I'm not sure what that has to do with my knowing Violet Damasia, but I will say, and I know the Picks are here, and Mrs. Pick knew her very well, so I don't know, maybe Mrs. Pick, if you want to address some of, I'm not quite sure what the question has to do with her. I think that it's apparent in Barnes' writing that his fascination with Glackens was as much fueled by his friendship with Glackens as his admiration for his work. Barnes was someone who had tremendous loyalty to friends and family, and unless he felt in some ways as though he was being betrayed, and when people betrayed him, they knew it. But I think that that was a large part of it. I mean, there are works in the gallery by Nolte, who was not a trained artist per se, but that's not why things are there. Barnes selected work. He selected work that he liked and admired. He also selected work that he didn't. He bought bad paintings by great artists. In his letters to George O'Keeffe, which I find fascinating, he says, "I love your work, but it doesn't fit with what I'm trying to do here with this school." Barnes was not building a private collection. He was building a teaching collection. And so I think that had a lot to do with his choices, and certainly the fact that it's one of the most diverse collections of that particular period. The breadth of that collection is phenomenal. There's children's art in the galleries, as I mentioned. There, in doing this collection assessment, and we so far have now brought in, I think we're up to 37 or 38 curators that have done curatorial research on specific areas of the collection. Joe Rischel actually is the chair of that committee, and it has been in place now for 3 years. Going into, I think, we'll soon be starting our fourth year. But it's amazing to see the breadth of what was there, but also we're using the same system to catalog archival material as we are to catalog collections. And so we'll be able to, once that's finished, to be able to directly address some of those things. But the correspondence, Barnes talks a lot about why he buys different things, what elements of particular painters he admires, which ones he doesn't, why he thinks certain paintings are successful, where they have weaknesses. Even in the art and painting, and many people read that and say, well, you know, this is Barnes' idea of what was supposed to be. It's only the first 100 or so pages that are really critical. The rest of it, he says, here's my interpretation. But the idea is that everyone comes up with their own meaning and their own ability to perceive. Absolutely. Yes. We in doing our oral history project, and I so far we've interviewed about 33 people who knew Barnes, Mrs. Barnes, Violet Demasia. The general consensus is that the program shifted 180 degrees from where it was when Barnes was alive. The class size grew. It became a rote memorization lecture program. Instead of artists and scholars being welcome into classes, we find that they're kicked out if they're discovered. I've heard, and I remember someone, I won't mention this gentleman's name, he's a rather noted art historian. I was surprised. He said that the joy of life was painted for the stairwell. I said, it absolutely was not. He said, well, you know, that's what we were told. So the painting was finished 20 years before the building was. It's not possible. So there was a real shift in that information. Barton Church, who's on our faculty and has been on the faculty since 1952, he still teaches there, said, and I asked him, I said, what was it, what did it feel like when Barnes was alive? He said, the foundation was an active think tank for the discussion of aesthetics and the love of painting. Those are not words that people would really associate with the foundation in the past, but we've done a great deal to ensure that that's the way it can be interpreted now. So there's a lot of very exciting things that we've been doing with the program that I'm very proud of.
Maybe I have a question to you, Kimberly. You pointed out very well that it's not a museum, but a teaching institution. But isn't one of the problems that it looks like a museum, maybe too much like a museum, if you visit it today without knowing all this background, the letters, the archive, which are invisible and are not meant to be seen, like here you have papers on the wall. How can one say that it's a different museum, or what kind of future for an institution like that would you see? A museum that is not a museum, a collection that is not a collection, but something that is a social and ethical movement, as it were. How do you see the future of this paradoxical institution given, you know, today's technology and the fact that you can show things on television screens and so on. But how do you see the future of all these?
That's a big question. Let me try and get through a couple pieces of it. Museums of 1922 were very different in the same way schools of 1922 were very different. And so, you know, we tend to look at history through contemporary eyes. We have been trained to what the context is of museum in a way that really didn't exist then. And so, in looking at it through contemporary eyes, well, why shouldn't it be a museum? It has great art. But the way the art is supposed to be used in conjunction with horticultural material, erasing lines between decorative arts and fine arts, showing diverse collections all in one space, which, by the way, has been in an area that many museums have been experimenting with lately, but still won't sort of say, and it's experimenting with Barnesian tradition, but I digress. he was really a brilliant guy, he really was. Museums tend to, the tradition of museums in this country and their history came as much out of shifts in tax law as they did out of issues of appreciation and education. A lot of people mix up, for example, that Barnes was, the mansion has not been turned into anything. It was built as a school. It's not a private collection made public. We mix that up because when IRS law was established, that created the nonprofit. Many private collections became public. Family members went on boards. There were no public hours, and God forbid there should be education. We've since now gone through years of reform in that, and we recognize museums to be institutions for educating, for learning and appreciating. They've become safe spaces in our community for society. They've become safe spaces for, and I attended a conference last year in Vancouver where we talked about how museums around in New York and New Jersey after the 9/11 attacks became safe spaces for community to just come and be together. So the role that museums play in our society has vastly changed. Curiously, that's what Barnes in many ways was doing. I found, actually discovered this, that one of my childhood friend's mother used to sing at the Barnes Foundation. She went to the New Jersey Manual Training Institute for Colored Youth at Bordentown. I had her at my house. I moved back and said, "Why don't you come over for dinner? I haven't seen you in years. And bring your mother. I'll bring my mother. And they'll sit and talk about all of us in the corner like they all, you know." And she started, "Oh, when I was little, when I was young," and she's going on, and she said, "And Dr. and Mrs. Barnes were so nice." I said, "Wait, back up." And she told me about how she would come there with the Glee Club and sing. And we had heard that Barnes would have these concerts of Negro spirituals in the gallery, and that he had live music in the gallery. A lot of people don't realize that. When there wasn't live music, he would play records on the record player. There were certain pieces of music that he would coordinate with or said would be advantageous to viewing particular pieces. But I asked her who came to those concerts and what was the format. Did Barnes lecture? Did he talk about Negro spirituals? She said no. He would just have us come. He would have worked out the program in advance. I said, "Who would come?" He said, "Oh, his friends." He said, "They would be business people, church leaders." I said, "Was it a mix?" She said, "Oh, yeah, the audience was always mixed. You know, as many," and she said, "Negroes," which, you know, tells her age. She said, "And everybody would be together." I said, "And then what would happen?" He said, "After that, we'd all go in and have a meal. Safe space for dealing with harder issues." And so we look at that very differently. What would the foundation be in its future, and what are we envisioning? We're envisioning that the uniqueness of the Barnes Foundation remains wherever it is. This is something that people seem to miss because the media has done such a terrible job of reporting accurately. All of the documents have said from the beginning that the Barnes remains an educational institution and that the ensembles and the room relationships stay the same. I can't tell you how many times I've gone on to people and said, "Oh, you said you're going to make it bigger." We have not said that. The uniqueness of that foundation and what Barnes did is that it provides an intense, intimate environment for the long-term study of aesthetics in an object-based, student-centered, discussion-based education program. And that's what makes that organization unique. And why give up that uniqueness when it has, it's what makes it so special. I'll say one other thing about this issue of museum, and that is that I think it's time that society has grown weary with the context of the museum. There's another way to interface and engage with art. This is one of those kinds of spaces. There are fewer of these kinds of spaces or places like the Barns than there are the traditional white box label in the lower left-hand corner, people walking, shuffling silently as voyeurs. You know, I love museums. I really do. Don't get me wrong. I'm a museum professional. However, I often go places and say to people, you know, what'd you just see in there? Faces go blank. They try to remember what they just read. Why don't people talk in museums? Why don't they talk about the art? They're busy reading. There has to be room for more than one contextual framework through which we experience art. And as a society, we should welcome all comers. This notion of definition of saying, well, the mayonnaise jar isn't quite round enough, so it can't be mayonnaise. We would never do that. But some notion that there's a hierarchical constant that exists in how we look at art, I think it's an idea that's whose time has come and gone.
Well, thank you very much, and this is a very fitting conclusion.
Well done.
Thank you.